Welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.24. Yeah, I have no words, man. This sucks. Hope you still enjoy the show, though. Things that I took from the MGO podcast when I used to be on that and then started the hockey cast was sort of Brian's like way to open the show. He'd always have some like random thing to talk about, or what music played on his cab ride there, or some show he watched that was basically irrelevant, but he tried to tie into sports. So I've like tried to plan that every week, and it's usually, I always try to blindside it with you, because you had a really great point that like when you started full time, your ego was going to get way too big for the show, and the hockey cast job was to keep you in check. And so I've tried to keep you on edge and also get to know you and a little bit me for the listeners. But this week is going to be different. Normally it's something funny or out of left field that we go on and talk about, but we had a very nice thread that was given to us thanking us for all the work that we've put in this year by, wow, I can't even pronounce his name, M. Jeffriau. Is that how it is? Anyway, it's what it looks like, Jeffriau. Anyway, thank you very much for that. He got a bunch of upvotes. We got a ton of comments. People seem to really, really like our coverage, think that we know what we're talking about and do a pretty good job. I know you responded in there and said thank you and had a nice GIF and everything. And people even responded to that. And I mean, we've had kind of the same guys that would comment on our stuff and talk about hockey, but this was pretty a lot of different people that chimed in here, including a bunch of people who've been around for a while. And it was just sort of humbling because, you know, I mean, it's college hockey, right? Like the whole joke of our podcast and even some of the things we write is like, no one cares. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, Michigan could sign a 5-star recruit and versus Michigan could make the Frozen Four and everyone wants to talk about the recruit, and that's okay. I mean, we know our place, you know, everyone knows what it is, but it was just kind of cool to see people recognize it and understand sort of like the work that we've put in and appreciate it, and said some very nice things that, you know, I kind of on my happiest day want to think are true. Like, I think we really do a good job. I know I see the work you put in. I know what I put in. And, you know, some people called us some of the best covering college hockey. And obviously we know a few people who do a really, really good job and probably cover it more at a larger breadth, but, you know, we said at the beginning of the year on the first show, and maybe even on like when we've done spots on the radio or the podcast, of like, you know, we wanted to do the best job anyone, including MGO Blog, has ever done covering a year. And this was a year to do it. This was the year that Michigan was going to have their headliners and chances to do everything that we've ever dreamed of. Didn't quite come to complete fruition. They did a lot and it was a fun year. But I think that we succeeded in that thread, and the comments after that seem to definitely agree. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. I know, you know, you've texted it to me, you responded in the comments, and I know you're appreciative. And, you know, we've spent many a night staying up way too late talking about either the game or what this team is going to do, or can they go here, or, you know, whatever. And, it ends up in your writing. I know you've done a really good job of posting pretty much every week, at least in the new year since football has ended. And, you know, you contributed to the previews that I did too. And we split up a lot of that, and you've put in a lot of work in these podcasts, as have I, organizing it and making sure we touch on everything that happens in a game. So if you miss it or you want to know what happened on a play, we pretty much go through it. And it's nice to be appreciated, but it's also nice that people appreciate us. And I want to say thank you to those people that do that, because, I mean, it does mean a lot, I will say, at least to me. And I'm pretty sure I can speak for you in that regard as well.
I cover college hockey in such a comprehensive manner that I did not watch the championship game on Saturday night. So,
um, I had it on, and I, people were upset about. I mean, there's a thing about ESPN, right, where it's kind of cool that you get Melrose and Buchagras, but then it's sort of like you made the reference to the whole Barkley, Kenny Smith, Shaq thing. Well, I guess Shaq isn't on there, but Barkley and Kenny Smith, where, you know, they cover the NBA and then they're brought in for the tournament, and, you know, they know some of what's going on. I'm sure they do some research, but it's very different when you watch every game, right? And so I just kind of, I had it muted because I'm like, yeah, I don't really know. I don't really want to listen to this, but I still think that your college hockey takes are probably as good as either one of theirs and most likely better.
I will say that I was kind of surprised that Denver won when I saw they were down 1-0. Especially, weren't they down 1-0 going to the third period too? I mean, that.
Well, yeah, but do you know how many shots they had in the first two periods?
No, not off the top of my head.
8. So, like, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a few minutes when we get to the game. And Michigan had, like, no shots for what seemed like, what, probably 15 minutes of the first period or thereabouts. Yeah. I mean, Denver had 8 going into through the first two periods.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of just felt like the Minnesota State special. And then it crumbled.
I guess very much wasn't. I mean, I don't think they've given up 5 in a game this year. I mean, what Michigan get them? I think they got 3 on them when they played 3. Them.
Yeah, I doubt they gave up 5 otherwise.
But anyway, do you have any other takes or thanks to give?
No, not particularly. It was it was a nice thread to see at the end of the year, and I thought our coverage was better than last year. So, good to see some people agreed.
Yes, very much. So now you guys can turn this off because now we're going to talk about the game and it's going to be frustrating and depressing. So thanks. And maybe you'll listen next week. Anyway, so the game starts. And I mean, like I said, I have, I think, 8 notes for the first period. And I think 3 of them are just the shot differential and how Michigan has no shots or big rebounds from Portillo. That pretty much was the first period. The game, I thought Michigan started very slowly. They looked a little lackadaisical, shaky. I think we were sitting next to each other and I was like, you know, Michigan looks kind of tight and not the relaxed, free flowing Wolverines we've seen over the past few games, who jumped on Quinnipiac, jumped on AIC, jumped on Minnesota, jumped on Notre Dame, jumped on Michigan State. I mean, basically, this was a bit of a different team in this game, and they looked like they had everything to lose almost and brought it out onto the ice with them.
Yeah, the first period was just an odd kind of 20 minutes because Michigan weren't totally lifeless, but they just didn't seem really comfortable in this sort of game, and they were not they weren't playing like they normally are. They didn't have the same degree of jump, and it seemed that they were being very cautious, which I think was part of the defensive game plan and definitely was a talking point throughout the rest of the game. And Denver came pretty ready to play. But, you know, it was, I don't know what it was at maybe the halfway point of the first period, but it was only something like, if I remember, it was like 4-0 maybe in shots at that point. Like it wasn't crazy high event.
It was 3-0 with 9:24 to go.
Yeah. So it was not like Denver had 1 or 2 nice looks in the first 10, 15 minutes and Michigan had 0. And it was just a very kind of like, yeah, I don't know what's going on here type of period.
Sammo had a really nice play where comes down the near wall for us and gets around a guy and gets into the crease, doesn't get a shot, so it didn't count. It was probably the best chance at the time, which was around the halfway point. I couldn't see if Krona like poke checked it or the defenseman tied up a stick and the puck just kind of went where it went. But that was really the only good look for Michigan for maybe the whole period. I think they ended up with a few shots, but I mean, I think this might be the time to get into, you know, I talked a little bit in the breakdown because we talked about it, you know, basically all game sitting there for what felt like 5 hours. But, you know, like you said, Michigan played pretty cautious and conservative. And it was like, you know, when we predicted it, we said this could be a barn burner that is lights the city on fire and is, you know, 9-8 or something. And it was like Michigan did not want that to happen, which to me was surprising because, like, you posted in some of your preview stuff that, you know, Denver is going to get you in odd man rushes and everything, but Michigan can do that too. And why don't you want to skate with them? If Michigan's ever going to have a team that's going to skate with any other team that's ever assembled in college hockey, isn't it this team?
Well, so I think that, you know, the one thing about Denver, first off, is that they aren't like a super fast team. They have some skaters, but a lot of their guys, like Brink in particular, is like the microcosm of this, where he's an undersized but also not super fast guy. Their thing was, you know, playing off their aggressive forecheck and their ability to pass the puck up the ice. And that's what Michigan was worried about. And I put in the preview that I thought, well, if Michigan gives up 9 breakaways, we're probably not in a good position to win this game. And so I think that's what they were guarding against. The problem is, I think there is a middle ground they could have played in terms of a more open game, but just like tell the defenseman to remember to make sure no one's behind them, right? Like,
yeah,
you could have done a bit of a mix. But the thing was, they didn't want to play a shoot and retrieve style. Shot attempts were much higher than shots on goal pretty much throughout the whole game. But if you look at the numbers, a good chunk of those were blocked, but a huge chunk missed the net. And that's because I think there was 21 of like the 57 even strength shot attempts missed the net, which generally means you're taking low percentage shots, right?
Yeah. Safe shots.
And that's kind of what happened, where Denver took away the middle of the ice and Michigan didn't want to just shoot into them, because the concern always is that when you play shoot and retrieve, that sometimes the puck kicks out in a weird manner that can create something going the other way. But, you know, I think coming out in that first period, playing the way they did, okay. But I think I would have changed it up mid-game a little bit and said, okay, you know, we tried that out. Not really going for us right now. How about we have the defenseman pinch a little harder, or we just attack a little more heavily in transition and try to just skate out a little more. I mean, I think the problem is that by not being super aggressive in the rush game, they took away a lot of their ability to.
Yeah. Because that's what this team is. I mean, it's speed and skill.
Because they can play on the cycle, but they do it a lot better against teams that are bad, right? They,
do most teams.
Against a Michigan State, like, Michigan can crush you on the cycle. But against a team that knows what they're doing and knows how to take away the middle of the ice, which Denver was doing extremely well. And the thing about Denver we didn't talk enough about in the preview is that, like, sure, they score a lot of goals per game, but they gave up 3 total goals in the regional.
Yeah.
And they
they're a really good team.
And they gave up 3 total goals in a Frozen Four. So they gave up 6 goals in 4 tourney games. Like, that team can play defense. And they can score, but they can play defense too. And so I think, I thought it was a bit of a tactical mistake. And I think they should have changed it around a little bit. The thing was also, and this is continuing this long rambling point, but I said this because I was on the intermission reports on the WCBN sports broadcasts of these games or of this game. And so in the second intermission, when Denver was up, what, they were up 2-1 after the second period?
I think it was 1-1. They scored in the third and then Michigan responded.
Were they up 1-0?
Oilers.
I'm trying to remember.
1-0 after one.
One. Yeah, it might have been that intermission. But I pointed out somewhere in there, in that either first or second intermission, that if it gets to a point in which Michigan is down 1 goal with 6-7 minutes to play, then they're going to have the defensemen start pinching a lot harder, which they were not doing throughout the game. And we never got to see that because they never got to the point of being down 1 with 6 minutes to play. And I wonder if they had gotten to that point, let's say they score an equalizer with 4 minutes to go, if they would have kept doing that, right? If they had been able to do that and then create more chances. I don't know. But the problem is they just didn't play the way they want. They sort of changed things around because they got spooked by Quinnipiac. But when the season's on the line, I think you should play your game and not try to do something totally new.
Dance with the one that brung you. Yeah, I agree. And that was the frustrating part, is that you kind of went out and got beat on your second or third best pitch. And I mean, it almost worked. I mean, that was kind of what I said in the breakdown was like, I mean, if Hughes finishes that 2-on-1 or the Brisson tip goes in, then I mean, technically it works. It doesn't really on the scoreboard because you kind of been outplayed and outchanced, but maybe it sneaks through and then, you know, you get the overtime winner and you're playing on Saturday, but you know, it didn't. And it's tough to kind of take that after watching, you know, pretty much every game this year and going through it all. And then you're like, well, wait a minute. You didn't even, I mean, all those people that were at the stadium and watching on TV didn't even get to see Michigan play. Like this was, they were doing something else for whatever reason. And it didn't really work. You know, I didn't think Eric Portillo had a particularly good first period. I think that when you get to the end of the game, he actually had a really good game.
Yeah.
But his first period was a little shaky. I think Denver had 7 shots and I counted 3 really big rebounds in that first period. The first couple he gets away with, but I think it was the second or third one that comes right off his pad on a shot from straight away and Stapley can slide into the slot, pick it up, change the angle. Portillo's out of the net a little bit and finishes in an open net. And, you know, that's been a bit of a bugaboo for him all year. There's not a ton of criticisms to give him. One of the things is that he does struggle with big rebounds at times. I didn't think that he had in the games leading up to it as much. And I think that after that first period, there was one more in the second that I was like, oh, that's kind of big. But after that, he seemed to control him a lot more. And I mean, the second goal that Denver gets is like, it's just a really good play. There's nothing that he or even Blankenberg, who's playing good defense at the time, can really do. But it's 1-0. And I didn't think that Michigan was out of it by any means. I was a little frustrated with the fact that they were getting almost zero offense. But, you know, down one going into the second, how many times have we watched this team come back from rough periods and overcome teams? Obviously Denver's probably the best team they'd played all year, plus or minus Minnesota, but it wasn't dire, I don't think. And honestly, Michigan probably played pretty good defense in the first period. I mean, they gave up 7 shots. If you tell me Michigan's gonna give up 7 shots a period, I'm gonna be like, they're probably winning this game.
Yeah. Well, I felt that kind of what we talk about with rebound control, it's normally sort of when there's a shot coming in off your pads, how close can you keep it? Can you, all that sort of stuff. The Portillo thing in the first period was kind of an all around situation, right? Where it's very jumpy overall, right? There were shots coming in into the glove that just, he wasn't catching and were kind of like bouncing down in front. Like it seemed more to be a mental thing than anything else, but the goal is definitely one where, you know, the puck, you know, gets kicked out just way too far off his pad. And when you kick it out beyond the defense and into the slot, it's just asking for trouble. And so you'd have liked something better, but the rebound issue mostly went away after the first period. So in the end, it wasn't a major issue, and a number of other saves he made, I don't have issues with his performance overall at all.
No. I mean, you get that performance from him and you expect to win. I mean, he went almost 4 periods giving up just 3 goals, and the second two, I mean, there's nothing you can do on either one. So,
yeah.
Starting in the second period, DU gets their only odd man rush. It was a 3-on-2, and absolutely nothing happened with it. So, I guess in that regard, maybe Michigan's game plan works. Like, they don't give up anything in transition, and it takes, a big rebound and a really nice play just to get their couple goals that get them to overtime. But Michigan starts kicking it up a little bit. And, you know, they found a little bit of shot life near the end of the first period and into the second period. It looked like they were starting to take off. Beecher had a really good chance from just above the crease, but it went right into Krona's chest. And then they get the equalizer off of a friendly bounce from a referee, which was the only benefit they were going to get from the referee for the rest of the game. And Moyle scoops it up and slides it up front out front to Lambert, who is all alone and finishes, you know, just above the crease. There's nothing that Corona can do. I don't even necessarily blame Denver's defense as much because of the bounce from the referee and then a quick reaction from Moyle to cut the puck to Lambert. I guess there's not really anything to do to break down that goal other than the fact that, you know, it's nice to see the fourth line contribute. And, you know, we'd said all year, if the fourth line and then, you know, the Beecher line score, this team's going to be really tough to beat. And I mean, the fourth line, the blue collar line, has really, I mean, they played what, three tournament games and scored in every one. I think they had six or seven goals total from that line in those three games.
Well, they scored the opening goal in
every game, all
three tournament games. So, you know, and that was one of those that's kind of like, wow, like Michigan is very fortunate to now be tied 1-1. And yeah, on the flip side, if you're Denver, it's like, oh man, we've been controlling play and now all of a sudden it's tied because of that nonsense.
And honestly, they could have taken the lead after that. Blankenberg was wide open on the back door from Duke and he just got nothing on it. But Corona looked like he might be a little bit late coming across and Blanks just didn't get enough good wood on it. And then Duke fed Beecher, who, I mean, we'll talk about him at different points, but you know, the thing, how we do it now, the thing about Beecher is he came in the first couple of years and he was sort of a driver to the net kind of guy, a big body that liked to get in front. And honestly, the thing that I've noticed about him in the second half of this season is a little bit like the Brisson thing that we talked about last week, is his passing has been really, really good. And Duke gets it to him. Beecher drives hard down one of the wings and passes back into the slot to Samo, who has a shot to take the lead, a great look, as good a look as Michigan had in that second period, and shot it wide. And I mean, like, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that's why this line has been so good, is that Beecher has been able to draw defenses to him and dish to guys like Duke that can finish in front, and Samo, who, you know, probably can sort of go toe to toe with Brisson of having the best shot on the team.
Yeah. And, you know, this is an unfortunate game because we talk about the Beecher line, talk about that bottom line. They got the contributions I thought they needed from those lines. And the Bortolo line comes through with the second goal. It's really just this kind of continuous story about the top line. That's kind of the story of the game.
Yeah.
And you just, I mean, kind of, it's an odd one in terms of your complementary lines doing enough and then your top one not.
Well, I mean, it's like the playoffs for the two teams that we follow last year, right? Like when the Avs played Vegas, MacKinnon and Rantanen didn't do much for most of that series, and Matthews and Marner didn't do a lot for the Leafs, and both teams lose those series. And, you know, both teams are cup contenders, but if your top line plays like your fourth line, then you're not.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of what Michigan got. Like you said, you know, they got contributions from literally every other line. And so, like, if the guys that are first round picks that everyone knows are leaving at the end of the year, chip in a goal, Michigan's in the title game.
Yep.
And didn't happen. So, you know, they had a couple of chances, but, you know, I want to give Denver credit. We haven't really talked about them a whole lot yet. I mean, they back checked really well. They blocked a ton of shots. Like you said, they took away the house at the end of the game. You know, I got the shot charts late and tallied them up, and Michigan got 8 shots from the house in the whole game, which ended up being almost 4 periods. I mean, that's just not near enough. And it's not what Michigan has done all year. That I don't have those numbers for every single game this year, but that has to be about their lowest total. Maybe one of those Notre Dame games was up there, but like, it just wasn't good enough. I don't really know what else to say.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, when we get into talking about the overtime session, is that everyone is kind of like, oh man, like if Michigan had just gotten a goal, they dominated the overtime. They, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, they had a couple looks, but in the shot count, yes. But when you just look at it, shot attempts, shots on goal, if you just watch the game and you notice, you know, where the chances were coming from, they were not the not coming from high danger areas. They didn't get a lot of great looks. They didn't get enough in the middle. And Denver, again, Denver took the middle of the ice away in a really good manner. And they defended really, really well. And they stuck to their scheme and they did it all tournament.
The last thing I want to touch on in this second period before we move on is I don't think Michigan has been offsides as many times as they were in that game. I think it was at least five or six times.
They were calling offsides extremely tightly in that game. And a lot of them were pretty clear cut. But there were also some that were very close and they probably got those calls right. But yeah, it stood out because you don't see that many offsides very often because typically it isn't called as tightly as it was being called.
So let me play devil's advocate here for a minute and kind of make an allusion to football. Because now we're reviewing offsides on goals, is this approaching sort of the point of view where if it's close, you let it go and then you review it, sort of like a fumble in football where you're like, I'm not sure if he's down or not. It's really, really close, but I'll swallow the whistle, let him return it for a touchdown, and then we'll go back and see where it is. Instead of being like, no, I think he was down, but I'm not really sure. Hell, I'll just blow the whistle. Like,
I see that argument, but again,
do you want him to call it more? Do you want it to be tight?
No, I mean, I would prefer it to be a little looser than it was. But in a lot of cases, offsides are not, you know, that close that then makes you feel like, oh, like we need to call it super, super, like, or, you know, make or change our approach to refereeing because we don't know. A lot of them, they are kind of just like, yep, that was offsides. And you blow the whistle. So I don't think it's worth getting crazy worked up over.
Denver got a power play right at the end of that second period, and it was all right. Portillo had to make a big save at the end. I thought Michigan did a decent job killing that one. There didn't seem to be a lot of notable plays either way. And once you get into the third, I mean, at this point, like, I don't know. I'm trying not to like. Like, everyone knows we're fans, right? I mean, that's pretty clear. We try to be really objective and we try to call out Michigan when they do things that they shouldn't do. And we try to give credit to the other team. But the truth is we both went to school at Michigan and that's why we're there. We're there because we want them to win a national title.
Yep.
And I'm just like kind of shaking. Like, I'm trying to type and take notes and I'm like hoping that the guy who is from like New York Journal of Hockey or something isn't noticing that I'm like super nervous and wishing there was a trash can because I feel like I want to throw up. And you kept like looking at me being like, are you ready for this? And I was like, Alex, I'm going to throw you over the balcony. No one's ready for this. This is the worst. I mean, there's something about it that like you're just there's probably no other feeling like it. It's like that tweet that Brian always retweets from about like why watch playoff hockey
when you
ride a motorcycle out of a helicopter or whatever. And I mean, that's what it feels like. And like, I don't know, every chance you're just like, it's so hard to not react to what you have to do. And Michigan got a couple of chances. Brisson had one close in that went just wide. And Samo had a great dish to Duke and Corona made the save. I think that was the thing that like, you know, we sort of predicted that like in the end, I thought that Corona would give if Michigan could get enough decent chances, Corona would let one in and Portillo would be a little stronger. And that's where the difference was. And honestly, it was the other way around because, you know, the two that Portillo let in were legit. The two that Corona let in were legit and Portillo gave up the rebound. And
yeah, I mean, Portillo also saved a number of other ones too. So
that's true.
Michigan didn't get a high volume of chances. So unless you were really expecting Krona to allow just a horrendous goal, which, you know, there was the chance, but probably wasn't super likely in one game because the chance any goalie gives up an awful goal in one, any given game is not terribly high, even if the goalie isn't very good.
Denver takes the lead relatively early in the third period off of a really nice play. A shot from the point is deflected in front off of, I think, Cameron Wright got it. But Nick Blankenberg more or less had him tied up. He was right on him.
And yeah, he tipped it right on the ice level, and then it went boom right up in the air.
And then off the post. And yep. It's just like, thanks.
Pretty
like
much.
Like, you can hit the post and go the other way. It doesn't, goes in. Portillo's in good position. Puck gets redirected, and there's nothing you can really do. It's 2-1. And at that point, like, I was trying not to give up at that point either. But it just kind of felt like, God, have we just been here so many times? And, you know, they just weren't creating anything. Like, if this was like a 5-4 game, you're like, oh, this, you know, you were watching, what was it? Panthers Leafs, like from a week or something ago. And it was like 5-1 Leafs. And then it was like 5-5. And you texted me and you're like, well, this game has about 3 or 4 more goals in it. And it did. And it was like that kind of game. This was not that kind of game. This was like anything goes in and well, that's probably it. Thankfully for.
And I thought, and I thought the winner was going to be like deflected from the point. So when one happened, then I was like, yeah, that could be it. And the truth is, the rest of the game, Michigan got maybe one good chance the rest of the way in regulation. And that's the one that went in.
Yeah, I mean, they had another couple looks, but they had the one chance where before they ended up getting the game tie, where it seemed like four guys skated through the house and there was a last ditch effort of a guy cheating over to take away a lane. And then the pass would go to the guy that had the guy that cheated over. So now he's open. And then another guy comes out of everywhere and the puck just kind of never really got in a position to shoot. And Denver just scrambled, defensed it away. Like Michigan looked like they could have 4 or 5 really good opportunities on that. And they all ended up just never getting to pull the trigger, which sort of felt like a microcosm of the game where you're just like, oh, almost, you're looking for that really good shot and it was never there.
Yeah.
And then, but they do get the game tying goal on, you know, we haven't talked about Estapa much, but he makes a really nice block going down on a shot from the point. The puck kicks out and Bortolo gets out with Pasta, and Pasta has the puck, brings it in. I couldn't tell if he was trying to pass or shoot. It looked like he waited a little bit too long. The puck ends up getting deflected off of him and the defenseman to Bortolo, who has a nice job of corralling it in stride and finishing to tie the game. And at that point, you're just kind of like, I don't want to believe, but I'm starting to believe again. And I probably shouldn't do that. But, you know, we talked about in January, Bortolo went through a long COVID / illness issue and didn't look quite himself. He was arguably Michigan's best player last year and was not really that for stretches of this year. But I will tell you that I think that in the last month or two, he has really bounced back and looked a lot more like the player he was last year. Not always scoring the goals, but like his like secondary assists or just setup passes from, even if he doesn't get an assist from it, have just been as fun to watch as anyone I can remember at Michigan. I mean, maybe going back to somebody like Hensick or something like that, but he would find like all the passes that Kent Johnson thinks he wants to make are the passes that Thomas Bortolo completes.
Yeah. I mean, Bortolo, I thought, was Michigan's best forward in this game.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, the goal he scores on was not a particularly great look. Like, I mean, it's not one that you think is like, oh, this is the greatest look you'll see. I mean, it's a kind of a
it's
weird,
not an open netter,
rolling puck, and it just kind of bounces in a way that's right there, and then all of a sudden, boom, he manages to put it in, and that's kind of the story where both of Michigan's goals in this game were kind of a little bit of fortunate bounces in the way they show up, and so. I mean, my thought when they got to overtime was like, oh, you know, Michigan's kind of lucky to be here. And honestly, we'll see what happens. I mean,
and like how many times you go into overtime and you're like, the team that's lucky to be there is the team that it just ends up scoring because it's just the way hockey is.
Yeah. Generally,
before they get to overtime, two things happen that I think are notable. And both of those are penalties against Michigan again. And
yeah, and the second one,
did you think the boarding on Brisson was boarding?
Yeah, I did. Okay. The third one was the total flop.
That your dad called you or texted you.
From Carter Mazur, which You know, I thought Carter Mazur really lived up to everything I thought about him in this game. A really fun player, really fast, really energetic on the forecheck, and he's a rat. He draws a lot of penalties. He knows what you got to do to get the penalties, which includes that. So, credit to him. There's an art form there. I was just shocked that that was called, where you kind of have a coin flip call later stages of a third period of a tie game, yeah, where the team getting the penalty has already gotten two of them and the other team has zero. Like, that just rarely ever happens, given how the distribution of penalties typically go and the inclinations that referees have.
And that's sort of the tinfoil hat time thing again, where it's just like Michigan didn't get a power play. And are there times when, you know, they don't deserve it? Sure. Did it seem like they didn't deserve a call tonight, that Denver was that much better that Michigan couldn't get a call? I didn't think so, especially when you get to overtime. I thought there were two pretty obvious calls that they didn't get, and the referees were like, well, we're not going to make a call in overtime. And it's just kind of like, well, I mean, I had a guy call me later and he was like, did you see the slew foot? Like, that's five in a game. And it didn't get called. And I mean, yeah, I guess you don't want to call a major in overtime to decide the game, but what if one is committed? Do you just be like, well, for the integrity of the game, we're going to allow this person to like do something dangerous that normally...
I mean, typically the ones that get called in overtime are ones that are very, very obvious in ways that the casual person really notices, typically like a tripping. That's the one that gets called the most, unless it's something like someone is badly injured.
Which is what happened to Samuskevich. He was tripped down by the goal and on the goal line there. And I mean, every hand on the Wolverines.
But
bench
he
went
was
up.
Not laying dead on the ice. This is what I'm talking about, right?
And this
the thing
is...
that gets called in overtime are like a trip that's very, very obvious, or like, you know, hit from behind and someone's jaw is broken and they're bleeding profusely all over the ice. Those are the two scenarios where you typically see it happen.
Right. Which is the case for the end of the third period in a tie game of a national semifinal as well. Yet that rule was not applied there either. So I'm not saying that Michigan should have won this game or they got screwed out of it by the refs. But if we're going to talk about this game, this was a storyline and narrative that needs to be addressed, is that there were some calls that Michigan should have gotten, didn't get, and Denver got their fair share. They had three chances, didn't take advantage of them. And, you know, yeah, they were probably the better team and drove the net a little bit better and drew those calls, and that's okay. But that doesn't mean that it was fairly called in the end anyway. And especially if that really was a slew foot where the guy went down. I didn't see it. It was a guy I trusted his hockey knowledge, and he called me and mentioned it, and he was pretty upset about it, and not a Michigan guy at all. And so, I don't know. Whatever, I guess. I'm used to that in some ways. Overtime, I actually thought Michigan was the better team. I mean, the shots ended up about the same, but Michigan came out and controlled the first half of overtime pretty easily. I thought Beniers actually had his best half a period to period in overtime, making some chances. Truscott had a chance. He walked in the shot, ended up getting blocked. It looked like Portillo really didn't have a ton to do for the majority of it. And Michigan got their two best chances. They had the 2-on-1 with Hughes and Bordalo that Hughes just buried into Corona's chest, and you're kind of like, man, how many times this year have we seen Hughes walk in and score a goal in those situations? He's got 17 on the year, and a handful, if not more, of those were chances in transition where he gets in tight and has the hands to finish and just buried it right in his chest, and you're just like,
Yeah, the puck rolled on him a little bit as he skated in. You know, that was a good look. But again, my thing about the overtime is that Michigan, yeah, controlled play, but like, I'm sorry, it was not a situation to me where it felt like Michigan dominated it, because there was not a ton of like The cross zone pass where the net's wide open and Krona makes a sprawling save and it's happening over and like, yes, they had more shots. Yes, they had offensive zone time, but they didn't have a lot of very good looks because Denver pushed play to the perimeter and, still gobbled up a lot of the shot attempts. And Michigan got a couple good looks and didn't quite come up with them. And then Denver got one and they were able to score on it. And that's kind of the way it goes. But I didn't feel like it was some high-rate robbery that Michigan didn't win the overtime.
No. I mean, they had that look and then they had the Bortolo amazing feathery lob.
And that's
pass
just, then that was just a high skill play. You know, I mean, that one wasn't like a huge but breakdown.
That was a very nice save from Krona.
Yep.
And Brisson, I mean, that was the great pass, the great tip from the two guys on the team you probably want in each of those situations. They get it on net and Krona makes the save. And that's what it takes to win a national title is making those saves. And those were the two best looks Michigan got. And then, you know, it's just a bummer because I thought, especially in their own zone, Michigan was pretty good and didn't give a ton away, especially from a defensive perspective, mostly all game, but especially in the overtime. And then they just overskate the puck twice and Lambert misses it. It gets turned over in the corner, centered out front, and Portillo makes a huge first stop that I could hear you just be like, whoa, like right next to me. Cause it was just that save. And then the rebound is there and easily finished. And you know, that's the game and the season. And it's, it kind of sucks that they'd been pretty good at not doing that all game, especially in overtime. They screw up once, and one time is too many.
Well, the overskating thing is a dumb, unfortunate thing that happens. But there was still a chance to stop that goal from happening, and it should have been stopped from happening. Unfortunately, Van Wy is standing around, and Hughes is standing around. And both are in the lane where you got to cut off that pass. That pass cannot get through to a high danger area like that to set up a chance. And then even then, you cannot have the rebound, be loose to be picked up. And both guys just not doing nearly enough on that one, which is, it's unfortunate, but
that's the way it goes.
Yep.
So it's 3-2 in overtime in about almost four periods. I mean, I don't really have much else to say other than it was kind of disappointing and gut wrenching. And, you know, we were talking later in the hotel that night and you pretty much summed it up perfectly where you were like, I really don't like it when Michigan loses the first game of the Frozen
Four. The first game is what really sucks. You know, if you want to lose the national title game, fine with me, but just win that first game because then it gives you two more days of feeling excited for this event that you've gone all this way out for.
Well, the thing is you just want to give yourself a chance. And in one game, as we found out, anything can happen. But getting through that first game, like you said, I mean, yeah, you're completely spot on with what you said, but you just want to give yourself a chance. And, you know, they just couldn't create enough opportunities to do so.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case, call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Yeah.
the hockey podcast, HockeyCast, says that we must have two segments, and, well, nobody really wants to talk about anything right now. We didn't really want to talk about the first segment, but that's what our contracts make us do. Alex came up with a good idea, and it was just to let's go through the players that are definitively leaving and look at what they could do in the NHL. And maybe, you know, we won't go through grades at Michigan because that's going to probably be next week's hockey cast. We'll look at what all the players, the returning ones and the ones that are leaving, did here and how we feel they perform to expectations and all that stuff. So this is going to be more just about what can this player do in the professional ranks and what we kind of expect and that sort of thing. We broke it down into a few different groups. The defensemen, which will be Power and Blankenberg, and then the couple top fivers in Beniers and KJ. Then we'll talk about Borlo-Brisson, and then sort of the glut of fourth and fifth year seniors that have been around for a while and where they will go and if they will continue playing hockey or what we think and what we saw that makes us think so. So we can start with the defensemen. Let's start on a happy note. Nick Blankenberg gets an NHL deal, right? I mean, it's a 1 year deal, but he's with the Blue Jackets, not with an ECHL team or an AHL team, with the actual Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yeah. And kind of surprising, that I think it sounds like they're going to play him at defense. Bailey was tweeting the defense pairings and lines, you know, from practice at Nationwide Arena I think it was yesterday, and he was listed as a defenseman, which I was always kind of just surprised about, because I kind of figured, look, if he makes it into the NHL, I always thought it would be as a forward like he was in the junior, just because you do not see many NHL defensemen that are his size.
Like, and you don't necessarily mean size, you mean height, right?
Well, and weight. I mean, if he was, I think it would be a little bit different if he was like, I don't know, the Alejandro Kirk of hockey. And he was like,
I would pay to see Alejandro Kirk play hockey.
5'7", 220. That would be a little bit different. But at whatever he was listed as, let me pull up what it was this year. Not something you typically see. Yeah, they 5'9", a generous 5'9".
Yeah.
175. So,
and
yeah.
We've seen him struggle against bigger bodies, even in that Quinnipiac game.
Not even necessarily against bigger bodies, just normal-sized bodies.
Regular-sized bodies.
He got tossed around often this year. And, you know, that's just normally such a red flag for most of the 200 hockey men. But Jarmo Kekäläinen is a pretty unorthodox GM, kind of thinks outside the box on some things. So, look, good on them for giving him a shot. We'll see how many games he can get into this season in the NHL. You know, obviously it's getting down to the end of the year, although still way too much of the year to go, in my opinion. Yeah. Very weird that the playoffs are not starting right now when the NBA playoffs are starting right now. But anyway, Columbus has 9 games to go. Their first one is Wednesday of this week. So we'll see how many he can get into. I think they now have 8 or 9 defensemen on the active roster for some reason.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, I mean, he has the speed and the skill and the shot to do it. And he's a good passer, and he sees sort of the game pretty well, I think. It's just, will he be big enough, and will that come back to bite him? And it seemed like you and I both thought it probably will, but it seems like Columbus is going to give him a fair shake, right? I mean, and you think he's going to play. Like, they're not going to sign him to this deal and be like,
well, I would expect that they give him in a few games, and then they would probably decide, maybe an AHL deal for next year.
Because they're in purgatory, right? Like, they're not going to get a high pick, but they're also not going to make the playoffs. And so,
yeah, they've been high on the hockey viz, like the pain-o-meter, which is the, like, it's the pain is defined as like not a top five pick, but not the playoffs. And like,
yeah,
they have long been one of the teams most likely to end up in the pain category for this season. You know, he's a guy with an interesting skill set, and you're always going to worry about him in the physical aspect, but he has a good offensive toolkit because of him being a forward once upon a time, and he's a pretty fast guy. You know, not probably a burner at the NHL level, but will still be able to skate quite well, especially for a defenseman. You know, in that sense, your comps are...
There are comps.
Probably like a Victor Mete, right? Like, there are those kinds of players. Mete would be your best one. He's listed at 5'9 as well. Let's see what his weight list is at. 184, yeah. I mean, Victor Mete that's would be about, your best comp for Blankenberg, and that's not the most encouraging one, because Mete's kind of been passed around a bit in the NHL, and everyone is always frustrated with him precisely because of the physicality aspect. But his skill set, he's really good at skating the puck out of the zone, and adds little bits of offense in the transitional game. That's what you would be looking at Blankenberg for. I mean, he's a unique profile.
Well, and with getting an NHL deal right off the bat, or at least a chance to play in the NHL, you know, you'd expect that unless it just goes horrendously poorly, that someone will at least give him an AHL to ECHL. It seems like you could expect him to be playing professional hockey next year.
Expect him to be in the AHL probably next year.
Let's move on to the elephant in the room, because he's almost as big as one. Owen Power makes his debut tonight against your Maple Leafs with
or yesterday
the Sabres.
Or, you know. Two weeks ago. Depends on when you're listening to it.
Checking us out in June. I can't get into the grading stuff yet because I have things to say that I need to secure my contract for next year first. But, I mean, he's a number one pick. And when you're a number one pick, the expectations are that you are a top pairing defenseman. And Buffalo probably didn't take him to put him on their third lines or their third pairing. So,
well, not in 5 years from now. He may play on the third pair tonight.
I mean, no one's talking about like, oh, what is he going to do this year? Because no one cares about what the Sabres are going to do this year other than can they not get anyone dead, I guess. I mean, like, you know, what do you do? You're going to relatively high pick. So Owen Power is going to make his debut. You think he's going to be a top four defenseman, I guess, for sure. You hope he breaks into the top pair. It was a weird number one overall because he wasn't like,
no, it was not a weird number one overall. It was a very predictable number one overall.
He
was number one wire to wire, more or less.
Yes. I'm not arguing that. I'm saying that he wasn't Connor McDavid or Jack Eichel or somebody who is like the clear, like this guy is going to be a stud.
I would say that Connor McDavid is the exception. Well,
okay. But there are more first overall picks who have hit at a really high rate. The thing with Power is that he has a little bit of a ways to go. And in any other draft, he's probably not the first overall pick.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weak draft. He held the number one slot pretty much wire to wire in the pre-draft process. And the things that NHL folks see in him is pretty obvious. He is, anytime you have a defenseman that size, which, you know, it's even bigger than, say, you're more insider size. There's an extra couple inches there that can skate pretty well, that can cycle deep in the zone, that likes to go around the net sometimes offensively. That's a pretty unique thing.
Yep.
There's not a lot of players like that. There's not a lot of players that height in the NHL currently. And let me pull up the... see if they have the height sorting here to
I guess sort of what I'm saying more is like when you watch him play this year and last year, did you see the things that are going to make him be a top pair defenseman in the NHL with any sort of consistency?
Well, it depends on what we're defining as top pair here. Because top pair on a really good team is different than on a different team.
But in the playoffs, a team that makes playoffs with any sort of consistency.
So what I think is interesting about Power is that I kind of wonder how much of the offense will translate in terms of, you know, being able to, because he's not like crazy dynamic, right?
Right.
I would expect offensively in the NHL to get points all the way he did, you know, in Michigan. Kind of getting those power play points where you stand at the point and then you pass it to someone, then that person makes a play. That's how I would expect him to get a lot of his points. I wonder how comfortable he'll be rushing up the ice in the NHL. I mean, Buffalo does play a little bit of a faster system right now. That was kind of their big change last year. What I'll also say about him is that Power feels pretty much like a slam dunk to play at least 10 years in the NHL. And that was part of why he was picked so high, that when you are that size, you will be around forever in the NHL. That guys who are that size and are very bad still get NHL deals year after year after year after year. And so it would not shock me if he ends up playing the most games of anybody on this Michigan team at the NHL level. So the other thing I'm watching for him is to see if he improves in a physical manner, because he hasn't been super physical at Michigan, but also the NCAA is a very soft league compared to the NHL. There's not nearly as much hitting. They throw out 5-minute majors for things that may not even be penalties in the NHL, if we're being frank. So it is a different paradigm. And so that's a different way for him to come up in terms of sharpening his physical game compared to, say, a Moritz Seider, who comes over to the NHL as a just vicious hitter. But it's because he played at the DEL.
Played in a professional league.
Which is the old man, like, we're going to bump you around league. So it is kind of apples to oranges. But when you are that size, the other thing NHL coaches look for is you to hit, especially if you're big, right? No one's going to ask Nick Blankenberg to throw the body around. Yeah. But if you're 6'6 and you're not willing to really get physical, there will be a problem with some coaches in the NHL. Now, I don't know if the Buffalo coaching staff would be one of those ones, but like that's something that followed Larry Murphy for a long time in his career, was that he was a 6'3", 6'4 guy who was not a big hitter and had, you know, got him a lot of negative flack in some places. But does he grow in that way? Because I think the desire from some coaches will be to make him into, you know, the Rob Blake, Chris Pronger mold in terms of big and physical. I don't
and
know.
Will he do that?
He's a fascinating player. And I think a lot of this will hinge on what Buffalo does, because I think him coming out of Michigan, he's got a lot to still mold and a lot of ways that an NHL team can play around with what they want him to do. And it is known that he is a guy who likes to improve and tinker with his game. And so if the Sabres are willing to work with him and they say, oh, we want you to do this or that, then he could round into a really good player. We'll see.
He, of course, was the first of the 3-4 Michigan players to be taken in the top 5. 3 that are leaving this year. The second was Matty Beniers, who was Michigan's 1C for pretty much all of this year. It was up and down last year with Bortolo. He pretty much established himself as the first line center on the hero line that Michigan assembled in the second half of the year, that didn't have the greatest game against Denver, but had a pretty good year overall. He's the number 2 pick, goes to Seattle, is kind of the consummate, pretty good at everything, elite at nothing kind of center, where he's going to be good defensively. He has improved his shooting and scored a lot more goals this year. His passing was always good. He was great at controlling the puck in the zone, finding passes. I thought the things that he did do well in the Denver game, where he did play pretty good defense and was probably spent more energy there than you would have liked. You would have liked him to do a little more on the offensive end, but I didn't think he was noticeably bad at all on defense, something that he's pretty much been all year at Michigan. He's probably not a number one C in the NHL, but probably a long-term second line center.
Yeah, Beniers is interesting to me because I do think he got a lot better in his D plus one year, particularly as a shooter. His shot came along big time. My comp for him in the draft cycle was Philip Deneau, who is really of a defensive center in the NHL currently. But I've raised the projection a little bit with Beniers, I think. I think I've seen more from him offensively, driving play, to make me think he'll be a little more offensive, you know, than Deneau is. Because, you know, Deneau, I mean, what's his most points in a season? Probably like 50 or something, 55. He's never been a super offensive guy. But I kind of thought what I had seen from Beniers made me believe 53. Made me believe that he was going to be more defensively minded, but his shot has come along a big way. And Deneau has never been a good shooter, whereas Beniers' shot has come along in such a way that now I'm kind of like, okay, he may be much more offensively minded in the NHL. So
it'll be kind of interesting with him though in Seattle, because they don't have a ton of skill to pair with him. And will there be too much potentially put on his shoulders, at least?
Well, I would expect them to, based on the way they play, to want him to be really sound fundamentally in defense. To harp on that aspect. I mean, I think now you could say that his projection is something like a Larkin or a Nazem Kadri, that kind of player. Both of those guys are a little faster than Beniers, but Beniers is a really good skater too. I think that he's a guy that you ideally would like as probably your number two center, but are really good players, right? Like, that's the nature of that sort of slot of the Larkin and Kadri, which is like, well, could easily be a first line center on a playoff team. But like, the best case scenario for a contender is to pair that kind of player with like a true drop dead superstar, who's the number one center. And then that guy's your number two. And you're like, wow, our number two guy is better than like 24 of the
most
32
of the league,
number one centers. Right. Like, so I think that's kind of what you're looking at. I like Beniers a lot. And I think that he was a good pick for Seattle because he has the intangibles. He'll probably be their captain one day, if we're being honest. Does a lot of the little things. I mean, he's, you know, if we're being real here, he has a lot of Ron Francis in his game, and Ron Francis drafted him. And I think that they kind of...
You look like me.
I think that he probably recognized that. You know, Francis was a guy who did a little bit of everything, except Beniers is a million times better of a skater than Francis was. But, and, you know, Francis was a good team guy. I think he was the captain in Carolina for a number of years. So I think there's some similarity there. And he was a good, smart, safe pick to build a franchise with.
The last guy that is currently leaving from Michigan's top five of 20 or top five pick of 2021 is Kent Johnson. He signed with the Blue Jackets. I mean, every guy that we've gone through, you're like, this guy's a curious case. This guy is interesting, you know, whatever. And Kent Johnson fits that mold as well, because I don't think he scored 20 goals in his career at Michigan. He definitely has a flair for the dramatic there. Some of the goals that he scored were jaw droppers. And so there's that level of highlightness that he brings, the consistency shift after shift of, you know, does he get back on defense all of the time? Does he look where he's passing all of the time? Those sorts of things. Can he make the fundamental play that can retain possession or get the puck out of the zone or into the zone or things? That has been an up and down roller coaster ride this year. It's not a surprise he's leaving because he's a top five pick. I am curious to see how he does, at least in the first few games, and then next year. Let's put it that way.
And Johnson is a Javier Baez level swing, right? Like,
you think it's that high?
He's going up there hacking, right? On this pick,
can't take no walks.
Yeah. So, because the thing is that power is interesting because he's a ball of clay still a little bit that you can do a lot with. But at worst case, power is, I don't know, Eric Goodbranson. And best case, he's probably, you know, a quite poor man's Victor Hedman. Let's go with that. But either way, he's playing like 1,000 NHL games. Beniers, right? I have a good sense of the player he's going to be in the NHL. Johnson, I feel like the best case is really high and the worst case could be really bad. Like, and when you have Johnson's skill set, unlike Power, if you're kind of bad, they don't run you out there for 10 years because you don't have that redeeming trump card called height that they'll never take away from you. So, my biggest concern with Johnson, and this is what all the scouts talk about, but I'm more concerned about it than anybody else, is pace. He does not play with a high degree of pace in his game, and he doesn't seem comfortable playing with it. And especially with line mates, often Beniers, that would play with a bit more pace in their game. You know, how many times would you see the Michigan breakout in transition? Let's say 3-on-2 or 3-on-3, and Johnson's instinct is always to just stop, or right.
How many times did we see that last Thursday, where you were next to me and you're just like, "Go, just go."
Yeah, and he just really slows the game down, and it can work sometimes. The problem is you're going to move to another level that's going to be even faster paced than the one you were just at. And, you know, he's also not like a crazy great skater at the moment. And that's kind of the issue in terms of looking at him and his comparables, right? Like we're sitting here and we're saying, okay, who are the best passers in the NHL right now?
McDavid aside.
You know, you have McDavid right there, obviously, but also the shooting and everything else. McDavid, what do we know about him? He plays
really fast,
200 miles an hour at all times. Beyond that, probably like a collection of Huberdeau, Gaudreau, Marner, some combination of those players. What do we know about them? Well, Huberdeau plays on a team that's entire ethos is just like, we're going to just skate as fast as possible at all times. You know, Marner, electric skater who makes a lot of plays at really fast pace, you know, kills penalties because of his speed. Gaudreau a little bit slower, but he's a small guy who's pretty speedy, very undersized. So there isn't really a great comparison there. I mean, a guy who was a good passer, who played at slower paces, tend to be bigger bodied centers who are just like really smart, right? Like the Ryan Getzlaff, Adam Oates type mold. The problem is Johnson isn't like a bigger bodied center who can, you know, you typically associate.
Do you think Columbus wants to play him as a center? Because he did not really play that at Michigan.
He didn't play that at Michigan.
Like one game, what, two years ago against Minnesota when everyone
was
gone?
I'd be curious to see if they do. You know, it's one of those things that basically every forward was once a center at one point in time. So you can give it a shot. I don't know. I think he overthinks the game. I think he tries to do too much quite often. Instead of the simpler thing. And I don't know if he can play at a fast enough pace. And if you're not playing at a fast enough pace and not making great passes at a high speed to suit the league, then we're talking about, okay, then you're going to need to do it more on the cycle. And he's not really a physical player.
Right.
You know, it's weird because you typically think about the guys who we talk about as the perimeter player, quote unquote, tend to be the William Nylander, Nikolai Ehlers, that kind of player. A lightning fast, you know, crazy fun player who then just sort of drifts around the perimeter when asked to forecheck.
Because he doesn't want to get rocked.
Johnson isn't that. He's not crazy electric. And so if he's not crazy electric and doesn't play at a fast pace, but also isn't like a burly digger, what do we have here, right? That's...
If I mean, you, I don't know. I think that's kind of the question, right?
If you're not, if you aren't really to play fast, then, and you're not really a guy who goes into the corners, then I don't know. And that's my concern. The saving grace is that he doesn't play fast, but it's not because he is like slow. He's not crazy fast, but he's also not, you know, skating with combat boots on or something. So we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. The next group is, you know, okay. So if, you know, I think, you know, we talked about like, okay, if you could just keep, I'm not talking about the guys that are kind of come back, but if you could keep any of the people that are leaving, who would you keep? And obviously there's like the, you could pick Matty Beniers and that's probably never a wrong answer. But the guy that like, I'm going to miss watching more than anybody else, I think, is Thomas Bortolo. And I think there was like a part of my heart that was like hoping, ooh, another day went by. Maybe he likes it here. Maybe he'll stick around one more year and, you know, whatever. And I knew it probably wasn't going to happen, but like, he's the guy that I would, he's like, he has that Kent Johnson. Like I said, he has that Kent Johnson flair, but he makes those passes work. And I'm not saying they're all going to work in the NHL because they may not. But he sees the ice. I mean, you remember what his fourth game, third or fourth game against Wisconsin last year, and he comes into the zone in overtime, yep, and dipsy doos around a defenseman, and then the goalie and scores, and we just sat there and giggled and just like, well, he's going to be a lot of fun. And he mostly has hit at all of that. And the problem is, again, he's not the fastest guy. He's not the biggest guy. But, I mean, his stick handling is... I mean, Alex Kyle was really good when he was here, but Bortolo is right there. I mean, he scored a really nice goal against, man, now I'm blanking. Was it Michigan State, I think? Yeah, in the quarterfinals, where he just is in right down near the post, two guys on him, gets the puck into a shooting position and buries it topside. He made, you said he was the best player or forward anyway. I agreed with you. I wrote a little piece about it. Against Denver last Thursday. I don't know that his highs are going to be high in the NHL, but he does bring a couple of elite skill sets.
Yeah, I like him as a third line center in the NHL. I think that he has enough there defensively. He can kill penalties. He's good in a face-off circle. He really drove a good defensive line with Estapa and Pastajov and like a more defensively minded center who could, you know, hypothetically chip in 40 points because he has the ability to make a couple nice passes and can stick handle a little bit. I think that's a mold that's there. Like a Michael Backlund type could be a comparable, I think, for Bortolo. He's always going to be a little bit undersized in the NHL. I think he's 5'9" officially, or at least that's what they list him as, but
with Blankenberg.
Yeah. But I like Bortolo a lot. I think he'd be a fun player to slot in to your third line, who can do a little bit of a collection of things, a little bit of many traits.
Brendan Brisson played next to him for probably 1.5 years. Michigan went with sort of the forward pairs and fit guys around their KJ Beniers and then Bortolo Brisson line. Going into 2022, they decided to go with the full-on hero line and putting Brisson up with Beniers and KJ, and that worked for the most part, except for a couple times when it really didn't. And it kind of cost Michigan in all of those games. But Brisson has been probably Michigan's purest shooter. He has scored goals from tough angles. They've tried to tee him up on the dot. That's his shot. I think Michigan's leading goal scorer or right there. They had two or three guys that were right around the same amount, about 20 goals. He has really improved his passing in his second year. He set up Beniers a couple of times, setting up Bortolo a couple of times, just with seeing the ice. And that's the thing that that we talked about Cole Caulfield last year, where this guy can score goals and he's a good shooter and he's quick. If he can learn to see the ice and to pass and to get the puck there, Brisson really did that against AIC, I think, and a couple, and obviously it's lower competition, but just seeing those passes and putting the puck on tape is an asset that can be paired with his shooting. He's taken some goofy offensive zone penalties over the last couple of years, but we've also seen him back check, and he skates pretty hard. He's probably not an elite NHL player, but he's looks like he's can contribute in a number of ways.
Yeah, he rounded out his game quite a bit. He's still the calling card will be the shot, but he can pass a little bit. He's played a little bit better defensively. He's thrown the body around a little bit more. I mean, I think he's a top six winger in the NHL.
Is he a top liner?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, we'll see how
on the right team.
Yeah, I doubt that he is a first line driving winger, because there are maybe like seven of those in the entire league. But I think that he could easily have a Pacioretty type career where he hangs around for a long time and is just an easy bet for 30 goals. I think that's like a good case scenario of how things could play out for Brisson. It depends on the chemistry he finds, and you know, he doesn't have the speed of a Kyle Connor, so I don't think he's going to score like 45 in a season the way Connor might this year. But yeah, he should be a good player who hangs around for a while comfortably in the top six and should make himself a lot of money doing it.
The last guy that we are not going to talk about yet, because it's not quite official, that is expected to leave but hasn't quite yet left, and obviously selfishly hoping he comes back for another year because I like to refit in on his line, is Johnny Beecher. If and when he does leave, we will talk about him a little bit, and we will get into his grading with what he did at Michigan, which will be pretty nice, I think, next week. So now we're going to move on to all of the seniors. I don't believe any of these guys were drafted. We don't need to talk a ton about each one because I don't think any of them are going to the NHL, at least right away. Mike Pastiov has been around for a long time. He scored in a Frozen Four, what, back when you were still an undergrad?
Freshman. Yep.
Freshman, look at you, child. But he has an interesting career at Michigan where he'd be healthily scratched. I've heard different little rumors about maybe there was some conditioning issues or he wasn't focused all the time, but I'll tell you what, he came back for his fifth year this year, and you said he was Michigan's maybe best defensive forward. He chipped in and scored 10 plus goals on a team that had a ton of guys that could put the puck in the net. You also talked a bit about how he was on a great defensive line with Bortolo and Estapa in the second half of the year. And he's just fit in. He's one of those wingers that is fit in a number of different lines, and he's done pretty well wherever Michigan has put him, at least throughout this past year. He's probably not an NHLer unless he works his butt off and gets some breaks. Can he get to a fourth line maybe if things go well?
I would be very surprised, just because his scoring rate was not high in college. And if you don't score very much in college, then that's generally a very bad sign for your ability to make the NHL. But I could see him in the EC or AHL
for a
few years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think his brother is still hanging around, and you know, his brother had a little bit of a better career.
A little bigger, wasn't he too?
Perhaps.
And he played center. Let's I think see. Nick was a center.
He's in the ECHL. Nick is 51 yeah. points in 46 games. I mean, I think that's kind of where I would see that's Mike at, which is like a, you know, maybe a little too good for the EC, but not quite an AHLer. That's where I would label him. But, you know, we'll see. Had a nice little career, and we'll see if he could continue building on some of the progress he made this season.
Garrett Van Wy also signed an AHL deal, you said, in Utica, I believe.
With the Comets. They are New Jersey.
Isn't Fort Wayne the Comets, too, in the ECHL? Anyway,
I know the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, but that's different.
That's a basketball team, I think. Anyway, Van Wy has been the consummate fourth liner.
Fort Wayne Comets are an ECHL team.
Yeah.
And they're spelled with a K, not a C.
Oh, is that what the cleaning solution is spelled with?
Utica is with a C.
Just ignoring my jokes. So Van Wise is like a great fourth liner at Michigan. He killed penalties. He took majors. He was physical. He got gritty, dirty goals. And a couple, at least one, two in the Allentown Regional. A nice player that honestly, in some ways, I wouldn't hate coming back next year with all of the youth that they're going to have and having someone knowing A, how to play defense, B, how to kill penalties, and C, knowing what the hell they're doing on the ice at this level, wouldn't be the worst thing. It seems like he's ready to get paid and got his deal. Probably not an NHL player. Will he be around the AHL for a little while?
He could bump and grind in the AHL. He's a guy that I could totally see winding up in the DEL, which is the old man rough and tumble league. It's the top pro league in Germany. That's the kind of league that would suit the style that Van Wy plays. But yeah, nice career. He'll get a taste of the AHL. And if that doesn't work out, he can always go to Europe somewhere else.
Luke Morgan was also on that line. He was like arguably Mel's favorite player for the last few years. Super speedy guy, works hard, his butt off. Everybody loved him. If he could shoot, he would probably be in the NHL. He cannot really shoot. They tried to put him with KJ and Beniers last year, and he could skate with them, but just never really ended up able to finish his chances. He's gotten a number of breakaways because he can get away, kills penalties, good chances for that, just never able really to finish. I will miss seeing him because dude worked his butt off. He forechecked his butt off. He put pressure on guys, just struggled when he got the puck in dangerous areas. Have you heard anything about his professional prospects?
I would say that if he's anywhere, he'd probably be in Europe somewhere, but he's the type that typically goes on and has a career in some other field.
Jimmy Lambert and Nolan Moyle are in the transfer portal. They are not using their COVID years at Michigan.
Probably because they have been told they are not being offered a spot on the
team. Is that official or is that probably, or are we not commenting on that?
I would say if they had the ability to stay at Michigan, I would assume they would want to do that.
Probably would. Yeah.
Considering they're probably going to be on like Arizona State or something. So,
hey, it worked for Jack Becker, right? He had
worked for Jack Becker this year. Yeah. So, I mean, Michigan doesn't have a lot of room to work with. And the fact is they brought in a huge class, and there's not that many guys they can ask to come back unless a bunch of non-seniors are planning to leave. And so, one thing should be noted that there is a chance Moyle and Lambert could come back, right? Things could happen and Michigan could say, oh, actually, we do have a spot for you, and they could come back. You can come back out of the portal once you go in it. That's kind of the Donovan Jeter situation right now. But
I think, ideally, Michigan would like them to move on because while they are nice fourth line players,
those players are a dime a dozen.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Postyov is a guy you'd probably want back ahead of both of those guys. Obviously, he's out of eligibility, but he did.
Yeah.
Was able to put the puck in the net.
He
a
had
few
like
more
25
times
points. And, so,
yeah. Not so for any of these guys. Really good guys. Everyone really liked them. It's a bummer they couldn't hang one final banner because I think that they took Michigan from not a great place and took them to the highest of heights and just couldn't get it done. But nice careers, good guys, and maybe they'll get another year, maybe a pro contract for a couple of years if things break their way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're good. We haven't heard he's in the portal, but it would not shock me if Jack Summers ends up there as well. He's a guy that could easily go to the ECAC or somewhere like that and play another year. Don't think there's any. I would be surprised if we found Gingell or Levy are going somewhere to play. But that whole class, you know.
That's it for the seniors, I think, right?
Yep.
There could be other players that leave. The word is that Hughes will probably be back. Beecher is expected to sign a deal, hasn't done it yet. I would be a little surprised based on production. You are less surprised based on point in his career and where he was drafted and by the team he was drafted. So probably will go. I expect Duke and Mackey to be back. I don't think anyone else is leaving, like a Truscott or an Edwards or...
No, those kinds of guys would not be. I would be very surprised if they did.
And we will do grades on all these players for next week, so we can talk about their years and careers and maybe a little bit of what we hope to see next year. And then we will have one final hockey cast at least after that, that will look ahead to next year, where we'll go through the freshmen, maybe where they potentially fit, if there's guys they could play with, what they look like. And I think Michigan's going to get some players next year, so don't get too down on it. They should be reloading. And there's a handful of guys this year that I'm already excited to watch next October. There should be some jumps to be made as well.
Final pieces of news. Obviously, the big news in the Big Ten today, Danton Cole has been fired.
You'd been calling for that for a while now.
Yep. We'll see who they decide to go with. Apparently, they're interested in the USNTDP guy because...
That's
where
Danton Cole was.
It worked really well the last time.
Yeah.
I've heard the AIC guy, his name has come up a little bit. That is a hiring I would much prefer if I'm an MSU fan. Although, as many have pointed out, a lot of the problems with that job have more to do with the fact the athletic department does not care about hockey and their facilities are among the worst anywhere in the NCAA. That doesn't seem like something a coach can fix, but if a coach is coming to work within those parameters, it's not a terrible job. It's just fallen on hard times. So we will keep an update on that. We have not heard any Tony Granato news, but I think there is still some discussion about whether he will be back at Wisconsin. And also, Michigan's coach does not have a contract after May 1st. So we will be monitoring those storylines in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I think we can discuss a little bit about that situation. Not even just the situation, but well, maybe the situation. But that's definitely not a today thing. That'll be next week or the week after.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. But those are all the off-season storylines that are just getting going. You know, same thing with other teams in the conference. Who is going to the NHL? Who is not? Ben Myers is. We're waiting to see what Nyes' decision will be. You know, kind of go from there.
I think Merkulov signed out of Ohio State. I think so.
Oh, okay.
So we'll catch up on all of those news at a different time, when probably in the final week when we look ahead to next year.
For listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 4.24 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Come back next week for report card season.